Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Apple bias. Today is Sunday, July 1st, 2018, and this is show number 686. Well, I have to say happy Canada Day to all of our Canadian friends all day long. Stephen Getz has been sending me pictures of how beautiful it is in Canada. So happy Canada Day to all of you. Well, in Chit-Chat Across the Pond this week, Bart is back with Programming by Stealth, installment 57, where we dig even deeper into Bootstrap layout. This time, we get to start playing around with the Bootstrap grid, where we learn that containers have rows that have columns that, and the importance of the number 12. You have to listen to it to find out why. I do have to say that it kind of made my head hurt this episode, a little bit more than it has in a while, but I think we stuck with it long enough until I grasped the concepts. I told Bart that the jury is out until I take a shot at the homework. You can find this episode under Programming by Stealth or Chit Chat Across the Pond in your podcatcher of choice. Or there's a link in the episode, a link to the episode, and Bart's most awesome tutorial in the show notes. Well, speaking of Bart, he's been teaching you and me for many, many years now. Between his Taming the Terminal series and now his Programming by Stealth series, he's attempted to cram vast amounts of knowledge into our brains. When I was a little kid, my mom used to complain because my father would try to tell us so much information about everything. And he said, children are like wine bottles. You should just pour as much information into them as you can. And while most spills off around the sides, some gets inside every single time you try. That's definitely true with Bart and me and all of the work he's done to try to instruct me over the years. Well, often when Bart is teaching me, I wonder, you know, when am I ever going to apply what he's trying to teach me? I mean, it's just like, oh, come on, I'm never going to need that. Sometimes I say it out loud, but I think it often. Well, this week I had an epiphany about all of this, and I wanted to tell you how it played out. I create the blog at podfeet.com using the open source content management system WordPress. You've heard me mention it quite a few times before, but let's run through a little bit of how it works so I can tell my story. WordPress runs on what's called the LAMP stack. That's a combination of the L is the Linux operating system, the A is Apache web server, then M is MySQL as the database, and PHP as the programming language brings in the P, hence LAMP. You can also run WordPress on Windows or Mac where it's called WAMP or MAMP respectively, but most people run WordPress on Linux. The words I type, the photos I upload, and the links I include in the blog post all get shoved into the MySQL database. From there, the look and feel of the display of the text, photos, and everything else is all controlled by the WordPress software through the theme that somebody chooses. The theme is written in the programming language PHP, the P in LAMP, and using CSS or cascading style sheets to help make it look pretty. It's through the theme that you control whether a site has a left or right sidebar, what color and size the headings are, and how the menus are displayed. On top of the theme, you can also install plugins, and they also modify the way things work on a website. For example, most people use a plugin called Akismet to control spam comments. At any given moment, I have at least, 15 to 20 plugins running to manage various things on my website. Well, Bart keeps telling me it's a good idea not to have too many plugins running because sometimes there are unintended consequences due to interactions between the plugins. I try really hard not to add new plugins, but they're so often useful that I add more than I probably should. Now, Bart taught me most of what I know about WordPress. I did get my earliest instructions from my buddy Niraj, and Helma has been a huge help more recently with CSS, of course. Bart taught me how to install WordPress on my Mac to test new ideas. He taught me about the database and what it means. He taught me about themes. He taught me about plugins. Without Bart, podfeet.com would not be what it is today. Now, according to the web technology organization W3Techs.com, that's T-E-C-H-S.com, which surveys the top 10 million websites every single day, WordPress now powers 30% of the websites on the internet. If you just look at sites that use content management systems, WordPress has a 60% market share. Because WordPress is so dominant, that makes them a very juicy target for cyber attacks. Now, how many times have you heard Bart say, stay patched and stay secure? And you've heard him talk frequently about attacks on WordPress during security bits. For minor releases of WordPress, I have podfeet.com set to automatically update, and I update the plugins manually and without question as soon as I see the little badge light up saying there's an update. Now, remember how I said Bart advises to keep your plugins to a minimum? Sometimes these WordPress updates can cause conflicts, either with the theme you've chosen or one of your plugins, or even both. Having a site down because you applied a security patch is distressing, but trust me, it is way, 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 way better than having malware injected into your database. I had to clean up a website once that I had neglected, and I will never go through that again. I will have my site down for a couple of days because I've applied a patch before I would ever do that. So far, I haven't had the site down because of that. However, when WordPress 4.9.6 came out, it caused a failure on podfeet.com. It was really more of an inconvenience, but that's the problem I needed to solve. Here's a description of the failure that I did have. After I write a blog post, I make sure all of the images are well placed. I let Grammarly tell me where I missed commas or had extra ones. I verify all of the links and I let Steve do his quality control thing. Finally, I hit the publish button in the web interface of WordPress. Normally when I do that, the web interface refreshes, taking me back to the WordPress interface. The publish button changes to say update for future changes, and WordPress reveals a view post link. However, after the WordPress 4.9.6 update, when I hit publish on a blog post, the web page simply went blank. Bart taught us that if you turn on the developer tools in your browser, you can use the web inspector to see what's going on. Well, I tried that with this blank page, but oddly, the web inspector was completely empty except for a header and body tag, but nothing inside it. So support for WordPress is through the community since it's an open source platform. I described my problem in the WordPress.org forums, and I got the answer that I expected. It was suggested that I change my theme to the default and turn off all of my plugins. Now, this is a wee bit of a sledgehammer approach. I was kind of hoping to use a scalpel on this problem. Changing the theme is a quick click of a button, test, and put the original theme back, so it's really not that hard. Reluctantly, I toggled my theme from my lovely site origin north to the reference theme 2017. Changing the theme did not fix the problem, and surprisingly, it did cause some problems I wasn't expecting. Built into the newer versions of WordPress are some customizations you can apply. So in WordPress itself, now you're not really doing the theme, you're not doing plugins, you're actually talking in WordPress. For example, I have no sidebars on my new design, but I do have a footer with widgets in them. Flipping the theme over to the reference 2017 theme and back borked several of the customizations I had in an unexpected way, including moving my footer into a sidebar. Now, Growly Bear on Twitter saw my distress and he jumped in to help. Might be a she, actually. I don't know. I just assumed Growly Bear was a boy, but we'll see. Anyway, I was able to sort things back to the way they should look with his help. But I still had my original annoyance. I really, really didn't want to turn off all my plugins to test for the failure. So I told you I have a lot of plugins installed, but not all of them are active. I would have to sort through which ones were supposed to be off and which ones were only recently turned off, and that would be a big slog. You know, I contemplated putting them all into a spreadsheet or printing the whole mess to PDF and scribbling on it, but none of this sounded like a good geeky solution. Again, it felt like a sledgehammer. Well, Alex from Site Origin, my theme developer, suggested a path that sounded much more fun. By the way, I pay for Site Origin Premium, and it's worth every penny. I get instant access to help. And this was clearly not a problem from Site Origin, or probably not, but Alex was there to help me. Like I said, his solution sounded like more fun. Remember that blank page I get after posting shows, shows pretty much nothing in the web inspector? Alex suggested I enable the debug option for WordPress. He sent me a link to the wp_debug instructions over on WordPress.org, with a disclaimer that I might need some help. I do appreciate that he doesn't know my skill level, since he does not know I've been learning from Bart all these years. In reading the instructions Alex sent along, I learned that wp_debug is a single line of text that you insert into the wp-config file. I was, of course, extremely comfortable FTPing into my website, drilling through the WordPress directories, opening wp-config, and inserting the line, define wp-debug, true. After editing config.php, I tried publishing a blog post, and I was rewarded with a beautiful message on screen instead of a blank screen. Now, one of the messages said, fatal error, and it ended with search everything.php. Well, Search Everything is a plugin I use to enhance the way the built-in WordPress search works in WordPress. Now, I only had one plugin to toggle off, and sure enough, boom, fixed the problem. That wasn't enough for me. I went to the plugin developer's page, and I tried to find a place to write to the developer to explain the issue. Instead, I found a discussion forum where a few people were talking about this very problem. Even better, someone named Carla pinpointed the problem to a failing call to Zamanta. Had something to do with JSON. And I know what JSON is from Programming by Stealth. Well, I didn't know what Zamanta was, but she pointed right at the problem spot in the code. The code was written in JavaScript, so I was really comfortable reading it because of Bart and the Programming by Stealth series. Another contributor named Andronidko suggested a change to the code which appeared to allow the plugin to continue even if that pesky Zamanta error was there saying that it didn't respond. Of course, I'm comfortable editing JavaScript, so I jumped into the plugin using the Atom text editor Bart suggested years ago, made the modification, verified that the Search Engine Everything plugin no longer breaks my blog posting process, and I felt really powerful. Unfortunately, it looks like the developer of Search Everything hasn't updated the plugin in over a year, so it's quite neglected, and there's no way to write to them to tell them they've got this problem. With Bart's security bits hat on, he advises that plugins that aren't kept up to date are also security risks. Obviously, I have to move along, and I have found a new plugin for this functionality. But I gotta tell you, it was kind of fun hacking the code. Now, I wanted to write this up to thank Bart for the foundation he's given us in so many different fields. My ability to solve this problem did not come in one lesson. It came in many, many lessons stretched literally over years. It came with patience on Bart's part as he explained things in the podcast, plus the time he spends writing up his extraordinary tutorials. It came with his desire to share his vast knowledge with the community. He gives us power, and that is a great thing. Bottom line, listen to Bart. He's a really smart guy. Well, I'm trying to be one of the cool kids and use Instagram. I don't entirely get yet what it offers that I don't get from Facebook and Twitter, but I'm trying anyway. My niece says it's her happy place because it doesn't seem to be as filled with, as much anger as Twitter, and it doesn't feel as creepy as Facebook, even though it's owned by Facebook. I want to be happy too, so I'm trying to be better at Instagram. My first act was to move Instagram out of a social folder and onto my home screen so I'd even remember to open it. Then I started adding people and looking at their photos. I have to say there's something peaceful about scrolling through images and tapping the little heart. It feels good. I started contributing some images myself, and there are things that I like and things that I don't like about Instagram. I like that I can select a photo, write a clever caption, and then tell Instagram to post to Facebook and Twitter as well. It's kind of nice to have that all in one step. However, then I have to go back into Facebook and change the Instagram handles to real names. On the Twitter side, you can't edit the message, so you just kind of hope that their Instagram and Twitter handles are the same. It's a good thing that Steve is at SP Sheridan on Instagram and Twitter, since he's the person I'm most likely to include. Now, while the experience is pretty good on the phone, I spent a lot of time on my Mac, and I would prefer to do my gramming from there. Is that how the kids say it? Anyway, the problem is there's no app for the Mac. Heck, there's not even an app for the iPad. You can go to Instagram.com from a real computer, and at first it'll look like you can only get links to download the app on the iOS App Store or the Google Play Store, but there is a button that says Continue As, and you can log in from there. So I was really happy I'm going to be able to do it from my Mac. Except when you get into your account, you'll notice that you can only view other people's content. And, you can heart or comment on their images, but there's no little plus button at the bottom of the screen, so you can't contribute your own images. I have to be able to contribute. It's in my nature. Well, I've got a solution to the problem with Instagram. And as you learn about it, remember, this is not just useful for Instagram.com. And it might help you with any website that doesn't want to let you play from a real computer's web browser. Now, you may remember Bart talking about how we have a digital fingerprint on the internet and how one of the ways we can be identified is by the information in the header of our web browser. You know, whenever we go to a site, we visit a site, that information goes from our web browser to the website. One of the pieces of information in the header is the device and browser version you're using. That information is called the user agent string. If you go to Instagram.com using a mobile device, Instagram does include the plus button to add your own images. So all we need to do is trick the website into thinking we're on a mobile device when we're actually on our big girl computers. We need to change our user agent to pretend to be a mobile browser. So getting into this is goes through a path that's a common technique used by developers as a way to see how their website looks on different devices. So it's really not that hard to do on Safari. I'm going to walk you through how to do it on Safari using the developer tools, and then we'll take a look at Chrome and Firefox. So if you open Safari Preferences and select on the Advanced tab, you'll see a checkbox at the bottom that says Show Develop Menu in Menu Bar. Once you check that, you will now see a new item called Develop in the menu bar of your Mac when Safari is open. From there, select the Develop menu, pull down to User Agent, and then slide over and choose Safari iOS 11.0 iPhone. I'm assuming that will get updated to 12 when we get to 12, but go ahead and tell it that you want to be an iPhone on iOS 11. With your User Agent set to spoof the iPhone, Instagram.com will refresh automatically, and now you have a set of menus at the bottom. You'll see the home button, the search button, the plus button we were looking for to add our own images, the heart, and the little person that shows you your own posts. It looks just like the real Instagram app. Now that we have our plus button, we can add an image. You probably know that Instagram was made to have square images, but they've recently decided to allow us to do rectangular images. If you're on a mobile device, you'll notice a little double arrow in the bottom left that you can tap to change from square to rectangular. On the desktop browser, though, even when pretending to be an iPhone, the image might come in really big and you won't see that double arrow. Simply scroll up and maybe even to the left a little bit and you will eventually see the button. It doesn't always work. It really dislikes high aspect ratio tall images. It has a lot of trouble with that, like a screenshot from the iPhone X. Nope, you're not going to be able to do it. It's going to cut it off. But who knows? It probably cuts it off on Instagram in the app too. Anyway, so now we've got our image. We can see what we're doing. Finally, you can hit next, write your clever caption, and then hit share. Sadly, you do not get the option to share to Facebook and Twitter, but at least you can post a photo to Instagram from your desktop. By the way, once the developer tools are visible in Safari, you don't have to mess around with installing those again. Those stay on there. However, you do have to change the user agent every single time you open Instagram.com, but it's not too hard once you get used to doing it. Now, we don't want to leave our Chrome and Firefox friends out in the cold, right? Well, they should get to play on Instagram, I think, so let's start with Chrome, which is surprisingly unintuitive. The good news is you don't have to turn on the developer tools because they're always available in the menu bar. In the far upper right of any Chrome window, you should see three vertical dots. If you tap on those dots and choose More Tools and then Developer Tools, you'll get going. Now, if you're a keyboard junkie, just use Command-Option-I to open them. And that's by Control-Alt-I for our Windows brethren. Okay, so once we've done that, once we turn on our Developer Tools, it turns on a big giant panel at the bottom of the Chrome window showing the console. And this can be pretty intimidating. It is a confusing mess. It's got tabs and menus and all kinds of other glop. I mean, it is an amazing amount of glop on screen. But if you can shield your eyes from all the glop, look for another set of three vertical dots on the far right side of this new panel you've opened. Choose More Tools again, and this time choose Network Conditions. I told you it wasn't intuitive, right? Network Conditions. I have no idea what that has to do with anything. Anyway, things are going to get a little less intimidating other than the five vertical menu bars in this lower panel once you choose the network conditions. You'll finally see user agent and a checkbox that says select automatically. If you disable that checkbox, you'll be shown a pull down where you can choose your device. I chose Chrome iPhone. Now, unlike on Safari where it refreshes automatically when you change the user agent, you will need to refresh Chrome to see the changes to Instagram. Once you do, you will now see that plus button to add your images to Instagram. Sadly, you have to keep this giant console pane open at the bottom while you play in Instagram. If you close it, Chrome refreshes automatically now and puts the user agent back to automatic. I have to say, Chrome's path to happiness here was ugly and clumsy at best. However, one of the reasons people like Chrome is because of the vast extensions library. I did a quick search and found an extension entitled User Agent Switcher for Chrome. There are a bunch of them, but that's the one I picked, and there's a link in the show notes to it. With this extension installed, I now have a nice little button right in my menu bar next to 1Password that I can tap and choose from an array of options, one of which is iPhone 6. This will give you your little plus button on Instagram. If you love Chrome and you need to do this often, I would absolutely consider using an extension instead of the glop-ridden developer tools path. All right, if you thought Chrome was complicated, it has nothing on Firefox. I found the instructions over on howtogeek.com, but they are so geeky, I didn't even test them out. After how easy the extension was on Chrome, I thought, let's go hunting for one for Firefox. I found User Agent Switcher by Linder, which is compatible with the latest version of Firefox, unlike some of the other ones I looked at. The one by Linder has 74,000 users and 3.5 stars, so I figured that's probably worth it, and I gave it a whirl. I have to say, of all the solutions, this was the prettiest. Tapping on the extension in the Firefox menu bar opens this very pretty little grid of colored icons to let you choose mobile versus desktop and which OS you want to use. I tapped on the Apple logo under mobile, hit refresh on Instagram, and there was my little plus button ready to let me play like the cool kids. So the bottom line is that I'm really annoyed that so many services are going mobile only, but in the words of one of my favorite geeks, Nightwise, we can make technology work for us. If you want to see pictures of Forbes and Tesla and maybe a geek image from time to time, go follow me on Instagram at Podfeet. Well, after every chit-chat across the pond, I end up by telling you how it's not supported by ads, but that I use Patreon to help fund the creation of all the Podfeet podcasts. It just occurred to me this week, after 57 episodes of Programming by Stealth, and I don't remember how many Taming the Terminals, that the Programming by Stealth episodes really should include a plug to support Bart instead of me, or at the very least, Bart and me. You know, I play a role in these as the stooge who asks the dumb questions, but if it weren't for Bart's really hard work creating his amazing tutorials that I've mentioned about 18 times in this episode and thinking up the material and putting up with my dumb questions, we would all be a lot dumber. And that doesn't even include the time he spends on security bits, like in this week's show. So if you can afford to help Bart out and show him the value you get from his contributions, go over to his podcast site, lets-talk.ie, and push either his Patreon or PayPal buttons. Heck, while you're there, subscribe to his Let's Talk Apple and Let's Talk Photography podcast while you're there for even more Bart awesomeness. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchatz. How are you today, Bart?
I am fine. I'm having this really unusual problem. I'm in Ireland and it's too warm.
What? Oh, come on.
Yeah, we have an unseasonal heat wave. Now, we're close to the Irish Sea, so for us, we're getting a sea breeze to make it bearable, but there's bits of Ireland well into the 30s Celsius.
Yikes.
Yeah, we're not used to it here.
Wait, which kind of 30s? My kind of 30s? No, you're kind of
30 Celsius.
Oh, wow.
30 Celsius.
Let me see what that is in fake degrees. That is 86. Ew.
Well, yeah, it's a bit more moist here with all the greenery. So our 86s are a lot more like your 90s.
Yeah.
You know, it's because I've been in hotter weather in California and in Spain, and it doesn't feel as oppressive as it does here.
It does depend on where in California, by the way.
Okay, I've been in the bit. What was it? Venice Beach.
It's still pretty dry. Yeah, we always have an ocean breeze, especially where you were in Venice Beach, definitely.
Yeah. So the biggest problem is nighttime, because we had a nighttime low last night of 18 Celsius.
Ugh.
It's like, that makes no sense. The sun is literally on the other side of the world. What business does it have being so bloody warm? And of course, none of us have air conditioning. So
right.
It's just like open all of the windows and all of the doors and try manufacture the teeniest of tiniest of drafts.
I always find it funny when people from hot places say, well, it's 120 degrees here in Arizona, you know, and say, yeah, and you have air conditioning.
Everywhere.
Right. Well, we should probably get stuck in. It doesn't look like we have anything too huge this week, but we should sure that we'll have some fun anyway.
Yeah, well, there's nothing made it up to Security Medium, but there were lots of things that are noteworthy nonetheless. But I want to start with a little bit of follow-up first. So we've talked a few times in recently about breaches basically, we found out through Brian Krebs largely that all of the major American cell phone companies were selling as a service access to real-time location data for their customers. And some of the third parties that they were using to gather this data or selling this data to were not being very careful with said data and were suffering nasty data breaches. And all of the carriers responded to the furore by ending their relationships with one or two of those more bad, if you excuse the terrible grammar, of those companies, the ones really caught with their pants down. But Verizon should get some sort of special prize because they've basically said, do you know something? This is just a game we shouldn't be in and we're stopping.
Oh, wow. They're out, huh? Just not going to...
They're out. They're done.
So yeah. Not disgusting, creepy things.
Yeah. So basically, that's just easier, right? Than trying to figure out who you trust with this creepy data. Let's just not do that. So
that's legal. I thought I had heard something about some movement on maybe that shouldn't be legal.
But well, we'll get to that because your state of California may be about to make some ripples on your side of the pond. So we'll get to that in notable news.
Okay. All right. Sounds good.
And the other thing we should follow up on is our friend the GDPR, mm-hmm. since it's now been in force for a little over a month. There are definitely some side effects. Speaking personally, I have noticed that a few times a week I end up on a website that says, oh, you dirty Europeans, sod off. But the strange thing is, they are almost all recipe sites.
Really?
And I think it's because they are stuffed to the bloody gills with trackers and ads and garbage.
Oh, interesting.
So what I'm discovering is that the recipe sites I still get are actually the good ones. So I'm not actually all that worried. I still get Martha Stewart telling me how to cook American-style dishes and a whole bunch of British sites for European-style dishes. So it's working out fine, but it just sort of caught my eye that it's the recipe sites is where I personally am bumping into the GDPR. So that was interesting. And you shared a tweet that I really want you to tell everyone about.
Oh,
It made me smile so much.
So I went to... I was trying to see whether I could run Power BI for Microsoft on my Mac, which I'm pretty sure I can't. I think it's Windows only, so that was unfortunate. But it's sort of like
there's a cloud version. I was at a day long training conference training workshop on Power BI a few weeks ago in Microsoft in their amazing new Dublin headquarters, which I took photos of because it looked like Escher built the place.
So anyway, I should check that out. I should check out the cloud one. But anyway.
Yeah, the cloud one will do everything and it'll work cross, because I did it on my Mac when I was in there doing the training.
Oh, good. Is it free though, or do I have to be a business customer?
I think you'll need a license.
Yeah. Yeah. So I couldn't even get as far as that. I got to, it downloaded, I said, download? Yes. And I got an MSI file. So, but anyway, in order to get that far, I had to sign up. And I looked at the sign up and it said, okay, put in your email and give us, make up a password. And the next line said, we are going to send you emails. And I looked at it and I thought, well, that's pretty.
It's not a question.
Yeah, it was not a question at all. And then I noticed that there was a pull down for what country was I from. So I thought, I wonder what it's like in the EU. So I pulled it down to the UK sure enough, it was a checkbox asking me if I was allowed to. And it was just such a vivid example of exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, it's disappointing, actually, that Microsoft aren't just, giving everyone the down to the same barrier. But, I guess they have... I'm sure their business continuity people want to be able to just email everyone and not only the people who say yes.
But yeah,
it's still naughty.
Denise Crown made an interesting observation. I posted that on Facebook. In our Facebook group, podfeet.com/Facebook, she noted that they have deep enough pockets to be able to afford to have two different systems to segment what they do to people into two different pieces. And smaller companies don't have the money to be able to afford to do that, so...
It's just easier to treat everyone with respect and dignity.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, I thought that was kind of amusing and annoying and all in the same thing.
Well, the tweet caught my eye. And I have to say, it seems to, because you mentioned me in the tweet, I got to see every time someone liked it or retweeted. And it seemed to catch a lot of people's eye.
Good, good.
Now, less good, the Norwegian Consumer Council have been looking at what this large companies are doing, Facebook, Google and Microsoft to be specific, and they had strong criticisms of the first two and some criticisms of the latter, being Microsoft. Basically, they're saying that, yes, they are all putting up GDPR messages. However, they're writing their messages using so-called dark patterns, which are basically psychological tricks to get people to steer people. And the argument that the Norwegian Consumer Council is making is that the GDPR says you're supposed to give people meaningful choices, and they believe that neither Google nor Facebook are actually meeting that bar.
Oh, that's interesting. So they're still trying the trickery, huh?
They're trying to meet the letter of the law and no more, and the Norwegian Consumer Council are of the opinion they missed.
Oh, very interesting.
So it would be interesting to see how
they... I've never heard of a dark pattern.
It's a buzzword that's been around for a while. It describes a whole collection of practices that have sort of become commonplace that have been found to be effective at manipulating people.
Yeah.
It's the privacy equivalent of the bliss point between fat, salt, and sugar.
What?
The food industry discovered a certain mix of fat, salt, and sugar that we cannot stop eating. And they use that in an awful lot of very, very bad for you food, which makes it staggeringly Moorish.
Oh, interesting. I've never heard of that either.
Oh, wow. Okay, so the bliss point was a whole big deal here because, here in Europe, we took it as it just proves food companies are evil. I guess it didn't make as much of a splash over there. Anyway.
I don't know. I think everybody tries to do whatever they can to make everybody want the thing that they're trying to sell them.
To some extent, that is true, yeah. And the question is, how much does the law let them do and how much does regulation stop them from doing? Because ultimately, in a completely unregulated world, it'd be quite chaotic.
Yep. Well, that's...
Okay, so notable news. We get to start with a story about America and a story about the US Supreme Court that does nothing but make me grin from ear to ear.
What? You've been drinking before the show?
I wish I had, actually. No, I haven't. The US Supreme Court has ruled that location data from cell companies is covered by the Fourth Amendment to the US Constitution. You do have a reasonable expectation that your every move will not be constantly tracked. I mean, it sounds stupid to have to say that, but that did need to be said because it wasn't clear that that was the case, and now it is clear. Set in stone, black and white, Supreme Court ruling, police need a warrant and probable cause to track your every movement. Thank you. That is a really positive ruling. And actually, if you read the ruling, it reads very well. So it's basically what they're saying is, you know, it's the responsibility of this court to interpret modern technology that the founders couldn't have thought of in keeping with what they were trying to achieve with the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, although there are previous rulings from this court that say that if you share your information with a corporation, then you don't have a reasonable right to privacy. But in this case, you don't have any choice but to share this information because you're not really sharing it. They're collecting it. So it's not the same thing as you choosing to give your information to a company. And therefore, we do believe that you do have a reasonable expectation and therefore Fourth Amendment kicks in. Infinitely more eloquently put. But, yeah.
From what I had heard on some other podcasts, it was the case that broke it was a guy that was accused of robbing some Radio Shacks. And the police department had simply said, give us like, 4 months worth of everywhere he's been.
And, yeah.
Well, wait, you just hoovered up every, you know, his medical appointments, everything, you know, that wasn't targeted. Like, was he at this location at this time? I have a warrant for that.
Yeah, exactly. And as is kind of always the case with these kind of lawsuits, you should never look at it from the point of view of the single case I'm in to the Supreme Court, because there are always ones where you're kind of going, yeah, but he's probably guilty. That's not the point at all.
Yeah,
the point
it's so is hard not to think that way, but yeah, exactly.
Because a lot of really, really important precedents that protect civil liberties come about from horrible, horrible people. But that's not the point. Right. Everyone has rights. That's what makes them rights.
Yep.
Anyway, good news. Also, I think in the good news category, your home state. California has passed through its legislature the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018. It is now on its way to your governor's desk. and he is expected to sign it. And there's absolutely no reason he shouldn't.
But what does it say?
I didn't have chance to read into all the details, and it hasn't really made the news here. So basically, it's talking about giving more privacy protections, more rights for Californians to opt into things and to insist that stuff not be emailed to them and so forth. And the expectation is it will form a baseline for most of the United States because sites are going to just make their stuff work in California.
Oh, okay. Right. And once you do that.
Yeah. So basically GDPR light. It's nowhere near as far reaching as GDPR, but it does lay down rules on what more restrictions than exist now on what companies can do with personal data of Californians.
Cool. I'm a fan of that. So
I'm hoping what will happen is that in next week or that in 2 weeks from now in the show notes, I'll be able to include a link to some more details because I'm assuming that when the governor signs it and it actually comes into law, that the likes of Naked Security or someone will do a deep dive that I can link to.
Right. I'd like to hear more about that.
Yeah, because for now, I'm afraid all I have is a link to the Mac Observer, which gives the very, very, very high level bullet points. And it sounds really good at a high level. But I do want to see more because I think it's going to be a big deal for Americans.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm excited.
This is technically good news. Google have promised they're going to update the software for their Chromecast dongles and their Google Home smart speakers because it turns out they were accidentally leaking your location data. So they'll plug that leak.
That's good news I'm glad you stopped beating me over the head.
Pretty much, yeah. Have you stopped beating your wife?
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
The developers of the OpenBSD project have yet again have highlighted yet another problem with Intel CPUs. In this case, they've named the problem TL bleed, and the long and the short of it is data leaks between processes that share a core. So nowadays, we're used to our CPUs having multiple actual cores, which means that there is it's basically lots of CPUs in one CPU. But before Intel started doing that, they sort of had a halfway house between a single CPU and multiple CPUs that was called hyper-threading, where one CPU sort of kind of does two things at once. And it's probably not surprising that when two processes are running at the same time with the same core, it's possible for data to leak between them, and that's basically what's happening. And the answer that the OpenBSD people have come up with is they're turning off hyper-threading because actually on modern CPUs, it doesn't even do much good.
So I'm not certain that I'm right on this, but I believe that hyper-threading is more the technology of how you thread two multiple threads together, do two processes at once, but not necessarily by the same processor. It's more, I think.
Threading.
So
you're thinking of threading. Hyper-threading is an Intel technology for running two threads on one core.
So I just looked up the definition of hyper-threading. A high-performance computing architecture that simulates some degree of overlap in executing two or more independent sets of instructions. It doesn't say necessarily. Yes,
The key is simulate. So it's pretend multiple cores.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. The second line says a feature of certain Intel chips that makes one physical CPU appear as two logical CPUs. Okay. Good. I'm glad I asked, though, because I would have left going, he's wrong. No, it's like, I'm wrong. All right.
So okay, the BSD guys basically went, if two processes are sharing the same CPU and using hyper-threading, you can leak data between them. For a home user, this isn't a big deal, but for a cloud service where two entirely separate corporations will be running virtual machines in the same physical hardware, that's a show-stopping catastrophe. So the BSD guys have basically said, here's the problem, and you know what the solution is? Turn off this old feature that we don't actually need anymore, and the problem goes away, and you lose almost no performance. So this is one of those stories where it could have been an auga, but actually the fix is really simple. Just stop hyper-threading. It's actually not helping.
But hang on. Isn't that also hyper-threading also used on servers, as you just said?
No. What I'm saying is, no. So the problem is only with hyper-threading.
Right.
So it's where you pretend that one core is two cores.
Oh, and you're saying...
But modern CPUs have multiple actual cores.
Okay.
Like an 8-core CPU has 8 cores.
Oh, okay. That one took me longer to completely sink in. Now I gotcha. Okay. Interesting. Well, that's good. It's something we don't care about.
Exactly. So it sounded scary. It sounded very scary. And then the more I read it, I was like, oh, okay, well, that was an easy fix. So I'm glad when stories work out like that. This is another story that I'm more mentioning because it's in the news now and it is relevant, but I don't think it's going to affect our lives for a few months yet. WPA3 is out. It has been released. It is now available for hardware manufacturers to start including in their products.
Okay, for people who don't know what WPA stands for?
It is Wi-Fi Protected Access, if memory serves. It is basically so WPA2 is what we're currently telling everyone they should be using to encrypt their wireless networks. So there was WEP, which turned out to be absolutely god-awful. Then there was WPA, which was okay until we poked at it a bit too much and it fell apart. And then there was WPA2, which, to be honest, the reason we tell people that your Wi-Fi password has to be at least 20 characters long is because WPA2 isn't that great either. So now we have WPA3, which, as far as we know, is grand.
So
for now.
When can I have it?
Well, in theory, today, if you can find yourself a vendor who is very, very, very on the ball. So it's really now available for any vendor to include in any product they start
ratified
selling. Ratified, finalized, official, out, released.
Wow.
And the hope is that there will be firmware updates coming so that you won't have to buy new routers. But that is entirely up to your vendor to decide whether or not they do. Now, in your case with your very fancy pants router, I think you have a realistic chance of getting it within the next few months.
That would be really fun. Now, what about my devices? Is that going to be all messed up?
Again, I would imagine it would be down to OS updates. And there is backwards compatibility, so you can have a WPA3 router which can handle WPA2 devices.
Oh,
so
cool.
Your smart cameras and stuff should be fine. And our OSs should start to get updates, if they haven't already, for your laptops and desktops and so forth, to talk WPA3. So, like I say, today you're going to find it hard to use WPA3 because it's going to take a while for the hardware and the software to get out there. But it's official. It's out. It's released. It's in the wild.
Listen to this. Here's a quote from Netgear 2 days ago. We, Netgear, are working with our partners integrating latest security protocol WPA3 in our home networking products. We will inform media and customers when this update is available. Based on our investigation, we deem that it's highly likely that the majority of products should be able to make use of the feature by updating firmware on existing product.
Woo-hoo! Excellent.
Our statements are only in context of personal WPA3, not enterprise. Enterprise version is supposed to add 192-bit encryption and may impact hardware.
Yeah, that might need a little bit more CPU power.
Maybe. Woohoo! Go Netgear. I bet D-Link will do it in about 12 years. Okay, that was snarky.
I'd love to argue with you. Not going to.
All right, very cool.
Yes. Now, if you are one of those people who just love keeping using old tech, A, you're playing with fire, and B, you're about to find that no secure website on the internet will talk to you. Because as of tomorrow, SSL and the early versions of TLS are officially verboten if you are to be PCI compliant. So PCI is the Payment Card Industry Association, and they set the rules for minimum security for anyone who ever touches a credit card or other banking information.
And that's like a global thing PCI does that for?
Yep.
Okay, because there's no little flag next to that.
There's no little flag next to it because basically anywhere in the world that accepts MasterCard, Visa, or any of the other major credit cards, every single website where there's a button that allows you to pay with MasterCard, Visa, or any of those credit cards is PCI compliant.
Okay.
Or they wouldn't be allowed to take those credit card transactions. It's the global... Basically, banking doesn't belong to one nation, so neither does PCI.
I did not know that. That's excellent.
Yeah. It's a buzzword you'll hear a lot. If you're looking at cloud services, they'll say PCI compliant. It's because any company that is... any for-profit company needs to take money, which means any for-profit company needs to be PCI compliant. And so it's a really important sort of lowest common denominator on security. And the PCI rules now say that you cannot do credit card transactions over anything less than TLS 1.2.
So what would be an example of a browser that isn't current? I mean, I suppose you could dig back. Oh, really?
IE6. If you're one of those IE6 people, toodlepip. if you're one of those people who's found a version of Firefox you adore and you just don't want to upgrade because they changed everything, it's like, tough. And it's about bloody time. And I hope this means that people will finally stop using the wrong acronym when they mean TLS. The next person who talks to me about an SSL cert is just going, well, I won't say get a punch in the face, but I'll mentally be punching.
Wait, they're not called SSL certs anymore?
Not for the last decade and a half. No, decade. Wait. Let's be fair. It's only been about 10 years.
But we've been saying SSL.
I've been saying TLS slash SSL. I used to say SSL slash TLS, and then I started saying TLS slash SSL. And I haven't been particularly aggressive about correcting you when you say SSL, but okay. I talk about TLS certs all the time.
I like the link.
Basically.
I was going to say, I like the link that you put in the show notes. They're walking through everything that's been wrong. You know, it's like, so you remember Heartbleed? Remember Poodle? Beast? Shellshock? Yeah. Boom, 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 boom. Can we stop now?
Yep. Yeah, so basically the first attempt at making HTTP secure was called the Secure Socket Layer, or SSL. And it wasn't a bad first attempt, but it was a first attempt and it suffered quite a bit. So they decided to start over with the Transport Layer Security, or TLS. So effectively, SSL2 is TLS1.
Oh, okay.
But that happened well over a decade ago now, and that switched to TLS 1.0. So it's been wrong to say SSL for a very long time, but for some reason, SSL sounds easier to say than TLS.
Yeah.
And it just stuck.
Okay. I try really hard to say TLS, always.
Just like I'm trying my absolute best to say Mojave.
Good boy, good boy.
I have my inner monologue trained to get it right 50% of the time.
Well, I've decided that maybe it's okay if people alternate if they want to. But, you know, just be lazy about it.
No. I'm going to get the right habit in there and then it'll stick.
Mojave. Who was it? Somebody answered it. Was it a grouper? Who said, somebody said, think of Mojave, sounds fancy. Northern California, not fancy. They're all a bunch of hippies. Mojave.
It's a desert as well. So it's the opposite of a French restaurant.
Yeah, it's not fancy.
I need to find something that's as memorable as rolling like bowling. Because anyone talks about J.K. Rowling is also wrong. It's rolling like bowling. And so we just need something to rhyme with Mojave like something.
Okay.
Mojave like wasabi. There we go. Wasabi. Done.
Okay. For some reason, that reminds me of a cartoon somebody sent me, or a comic. It showed two apes, and one of them says, what rhymes with banana? And the other guy says, no, it doesn't.
Oh, that's so bad, it's good.
I know. It's my No, it doesn't. Anyway, we're right off the rails. I'm drinking water. I'm just telling you.
I'm drinking coffee. That shouldn't have this effect on me either, but maybe coffee plus working too hard plus too much heat, maybe that does something to your brain. Anyway, very much related story. So we have talked many times about Let's Encrypt, which is a not-for-profit foundation which includes people like the EFF, but also Mozilla and a whole bunch of other people. And they got together with the intention of making it possible for everyone to have a secure website for free. And they did that as a charitable foundation, so that way you don't have to worry about following the money. Yeah, so they could offer it for free without stealing your privacy in return. Basically, you follow the money and it goes to a good place. It's like, you know, why is Wikipedia okay but Facebook not? Facebook is a for-profit company. Wikipedia is a charitable foundation. They are different. Follow the money. And so Let's Encrypt is like Wikipedia. Follow the money, it goes to a good place. And it's been pretty darn successful at increasing the amount of HTTPS on the web, which is really good. So the EFF feel it's time to learn and to tackle the next problem. And the other obvious place where encryption should be ubiquitous but isn't is on email servers. So the SMTP protocol is used to send email from one mail server to the other. So the way it works when you send an email, so you open up mail.app and you type an email and you hit send, your client talks to your mail server. But that's only the first step in a whole big journey that email has to take, right?
After because that, it's a postcard.
Right, exactly. So your mail server then has this email for someone else. and it has to try get it to them. So it looks up the DNS record for their domain, which will tell it what mail server their domain uses, and it will then talk SMTP to the other mail server, and that may not be the real mail server. That might be like a gateway that does some spam filtering and then passes it to another server. I mean, if you look at the amount of hops, it can be 5 or 6 hops before you arrive at your final destination. And the protocol, so SMTP, just like HTTP, has been retrofitted to support TLS. So just like HTTPS is just HTTP with TLS added for encryption. Well, there is an equivalent for SMTP, but it doesn't have as nice of a name. It's basically they added a command to SMTP called start TLS. And so any web server that, or sorry, any email server that strikes up a conversation with another email server can issue the command start TLS, and they will then negotiate a key exchange and start sending everything encrypted. Oh. So start TLS is the mail equivalent of HTTPS.
Oh, interesting.
And in theory, if everyone had a valid certificate, then every email server, even one run by the world's smallest company, could have start TLS enabled all the time. But
it'll take a while.
Well, no, but it means someone has to be signing certificates for email servers for free, and that doesn't exist at the moment because Let's Encrypt is purely for HTTPS certs.
Oh.
So what we need is someone to do the same trick for mail servers. And hey presto, the EFF have stepped up and they have called the project Start TLS Everywhere.
And the EFF's gonna do the certs?
The EFF is leading this project, and I'm guessing they're going to pull in partners. But basically, they have announced that they are starting this project, and the aim is to do for email what they have succeeded in doing for HTTPS. So the details haven't been announced. They basically said, we're doing this. Stay tuned.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I'm delighted to see the EFF do that because, you know, Let's Encrypt has been great, so let's move on and do it for the next thing. This is wonderful. I'm hoping that their third thing will be X509 certs for digitally signing email and digitally encrypting email from a client point of view, end to end.
Yeah.
That'd be great if we could get those certs for free.
So if we've got HTTPS everywhere and start TLS everywhere, are we done?
We're never quite done, right? But that would make the internet as a whole a much safer place.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you still have the problem that, you know, all of these technologies encrypt data in transit, right? So an HTTPS connection protects the data while it's flying through the internet. It does nothing on the server where it came from, and it does nothing on the machine when it arrives too. So there's plenty of opportunities for privacy breaching a la Facebook, where basically Facebook are mining the data they hold on their servers. Like, no amount of TLS or SSL or HTTPS is ever going to stop Facebook mining Facebook's own data to invade your privacy. So it's not a panacea. But having stuff not fly over the internet in unencrypted format is still a big win.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think of it like seatbelts.
Yeah. When you combine that with all the other things that were, you know, end-to-end encryption for chat.
Yeah.
You know, things are going the right direction, it feels like.
It does feel like that. I think there's less and less plain text flying about on the internet, and that is probably no small part due to Edward Snowden, actually. He sort of shone a big spotlight on the fact that there was an awful lot of unencrypted stuff flying around and being hoovered up, and since then there's been a slow, steady march to nibble away at all the plain text that's floating about and get it all encrypted.
I don't think I've ever officially told you that I was wrong and you were right. Years ago, well, on a lot of times I've had to say that, but specifically, you and I had went at it several times about Edward Snowden and whether he was a traitor. And I've decided that he isn't a traitor in my world. Whether he is by somebody's definition or not, I've decided it was a really good thing that he did. And
yeah, I'm going to say that morally, in my moral judgment, he's no traitor. He's in fact the opposite of a traitor. He's a patriot. But I'm no court of American law. So
yeah.
My opinion is worth very, very little in terms of, you know, his legal standing. But yeah.
Yeah. But I thought I should admit it to you. I've been thinking it for quite a like more than a year, and I just never got around to it. It was never in context where I could officially say, nah, I think probably it was a really good thing.
I love I always gain respect for people who can say I was wrong, you were right, and I do my best to do it when I need to, and I love it when people do it.
I
love it when politicians do it as well.
I learned it from my father. I know we're off the rails here, but it's a good story. When I was in college, I went home to his house, and I was sitting on the couch. I had my feet up on the coffee table, and he came in and lost his ever loving mind at me for having my feet on the coffee table. What are you doing? You brought up in a barn. I can't believe you got your feet on my furniture. It's like, all right, chill out, Dad, whatever, you know. And I went back to school, and it was maybe a week later, I get a phone call, and phone calls cost money back then. This is because mm-hmm. I'm a whole hour away. That was like $12 to make a phone call. And we shared a phone in our dorm, and somebody tells me my dad is calling. I'm like, oh my God, something must happen to my mom.
Yeah, what's happened?
Yeah, something's happened. Dad doesn't use the phone lightly. And all he said was, so I was sitting here on the couch with my feet up on the table. That was all he said. And I was like, man, that's pretty cool. I will remember to apologize to my children someday. And I have.
That is wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I would have really liked your dad.
Yeah. Yeah,
he was. Every time you tell me an anecdote about your dad, it always makes me smile.
He was awesome sauce. All right, we're on bullet 4. Because I keep telling the story.
Yeah, well, we're nearly done with the main news that we went to suggested reading. So, a nice quick one. Twitter have added support for hardware tokens like the YubiKey for their multi-factor authentication.
Oh, excellent.
So you can have an SMS message, which you shouldn't. You can have a generator, which is a perfectly good thing to do. Or you can now have a hardware token.
Cool.
So, all good, I think.
Yeah.
I also get to do one of those, here's a fire extinguisher stories. So the internet was awash with stories that you could bypass the iPhone's passcode with nothing more than an external keyboard. Mm-hmm. You just, you know, connect a keyboard over Bluetooth to your iOS device and the passcode is just vanished. Yeah, it turns out that the security researcher made a very, 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 very embarrassing boo-boo. And his tests were basically flawed, and he didn't really discover what he thought he'd discovered, which explains why no one was able to reproduce his results. And he very, very quickly went, my bad, I'm sorry.
Embarrassing.
Very embarrassing. But of course, all of those media outlets who hyperventilated, if they corrected themselves at all, they did so with much less hyperventilating. So it's entirely possible that lots of people heard the original incorrect story, and very few people have heard the, oh, wait, no. You know, the follow-up that went, no, that story, that didn't happen. So just in case anyone got the wrong, you know, heard the first half, but not the second half, there you go.
I thought I had heard that, but yeah, good.
Good.
Good on him.
Another fire extinguisher. So we have one in each hand. It is a true fact that the Gentoo Linux GitHub account, in fact, the GitHub organization, which is like a collection of accounts, but that's not important.
Owned by Microsoft.
The Gentoo, indeed. Anyway, Gentoo's GitHub did get hacked. Totally and completely owned, mysterious code added into the repo. You should consider every line of code on that Git repo to be tainted, to be untrustworthy, to be flawed. This does not mean that you should all set your hair on fire if you use Gentoo Linux. Because the GitHub repo that was totally, completely, and utterly pwned is a mirror of the actual properly secured and completely safe GitHub repo that's actually hosting the code running on all of your computers. So it is perfectly safe to keep using Gentoo, and it is true that their GitHub got completely hacked. It's also true that they were extremely good at responding to this problem. They had an announcement out within 30 minutes. They did not beat around the bush. They did not try to get someone from PR to smoosh over it to make it not sound as, you know, as bad as it is. They were upfront, honest, clear, and concise, and they should be congratulated for it. And if you're a Gentoo user, don't panic.
But if you downloaded from the mirror on GitHub a Gentoo Linux and had installed it and done all your stuff, you are still
you would have
screwed.
To compile it.
Yeah.
You would have to compile it because it's a source code repository. It's not a distribution of the actual installer. It's the source code. So if you were making your own version of Gentoo and you downloaded from their GitHub in the half hour that it was compromised before they noticed, and then compiled your stuff against it, then your stuff is now tainted.
Okay.
So, they were, because they were so on the ball here, it's all in all, I think they
as good as it could have been.
This very, very well. Yeah, pretty much. So again, if you're running Gen 2 Linux, you're fine. Suggested reading. Lots of stuff in here. Some things I definitely want to draw people's attention to. Some things we can just sort of fly over. Tips and tricks, I think it's probably, or sorry, PSA's tips and advice. Intego are warning that there's a phishing campaign that seems to be doing the rounds in America predominantly, where there's automated dialers leaving you voicemail pretending to be Apple trying to scare you into handing over your iCloud credentials. It isn't, right? It doesn't matter how convincing it sounds. If someone leaves you a voicemail asking you for your Apple ID, no. No, it's no.
Apple won't do that. Somebody calling you asking you for anything, no.
Pretty much, yeah.
Right.
Macworld had an interesting article on what you need to do when you inherit a Mac, because it's kind of important that you sort out, make sure that you get rid of activation lock and stuff and get all of that kind of stuff done immediately upon taking over a Mac from someone who's passed away or from someone who's handed it down to you even. They don't have to have passed away. Because if you don't sort all of that stuff out while you still have all the relevant paperwork and all the relevant passwords available to you, you will be fine for a year or so, and then you're going to try reinstall the OS and find yourself up against activation lock and locked out of a computer you thought you owned. And then you're going to be in for a world of trouble.
Activation lock on a Mac?
It's basically the thing where if you try to reinstall the OS, they say, okay, give us your iCloud password or we're going to lock it down as if it was an iOS device we just locked down.
Hang on. Mac OS is protected by... Your
can be. It can be enabled.
Really? Where is that?
Oh yeah, since the lab at really? Least at least I think we were into Californian places, but not by much.
Huh.
Yeah, it's been around for a while.
Is that
it's
something you actually turn on a Mac?
I do. On my laptop actually, sorry, I do on my laptops.
But I mean I know that's there for
If you turn on Find My Mac, it's basically in there somewhere.
Part of Find My Mac. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, because then your iPhone is part of Find My iPhone.
But why is this article only talking about from somebody who's the estate of a deceased person? Isn't this true if you buy a Mac?
It's not only.
Well, that's the title.
So they're saying if you...
Avoid
that is the title, but when they say inherit, they don't necessarily mean from a dead person. If someone hands you down a Mac, that's also inheriting a Mac.
No,
right?
If you buy
a new Mac and give me your old one.
They aren't talking about that. It says, avoid a huge headache and do these things before you accept or buy a Mac from the estate of a deceased person. Wouldn't this also be true
further
if they aren't deceased?
Further in the article, they go on to explain that this is also true for other cases. So basically, there was an anecdote triggered the writing of the article. The anecdote gave them the headline, and then they go on to say, this is also true if someone just hands you down a Mac.
Or you buy a Mac.
Or actually, if you buy a Mac, you need to make sure that this kind of stuff, before you hand over any money, you need to make sure that it's not activation locked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that goes for an iPhone, double, triple as well.
Right. Like, I knew about that. But so is this about File Vault? No. It's about all kinds of things.
No, it's a firmware password. You just won't be able to get that Mac to reinstall until you have the iCloud password of the person who locked it. So effectively, you can't steal the Mac. And that means that if that's set up and you think you've bought it, well, you haven't bought it because you can't actually install an OS on the bloody thing.
Okay. I absolutely believe you. I feel like I was on vacation that day or something. Like, I don't have any memory of it. I'm probably just not thinking. I will find it and read about it.
Yeah, it's not new.
Yeah.
It's just basically something happened to one of within the monkey sphere of one of the authors over at Intego, and so they wrote an article about it. But I thought it was worth sharing because I think a lot of people forget that we have these anti-theft technologies, which are a good thing, until you forget about them and then they bite you in the backside.
Yeah, I'm trying to look it up on from Apple, and their activation lock, they're only talking about it on iOS.
I don't think it's called, it's possibly not called activation lock, it's possibly called something else, but basically it's part of the Find My Mac feature and it behaves in that same way where you need the Apple ID you need the password of the Apple ID that's locked to the device.
Okay. All right. I will do research on my own to go remind myself of this.
Yes. And another PSA tips and advice article that caught my eye is also from Intego, how to secure your home router. It's just some general advice and, you know, you or I probably don't need this as a reminder, but it's the kind of link it might be worthwhile sending around to some of your less nerdy friends and family. In terms of major breaches, just before we started recording, my RSS feed ticked with a new one. An American marketing firm has lost its database of personal information on 340 million Americans. Details are just coming out, but it basically looks like it's your name, your email address, your physical address, your telephone number, and then basically everything they've managed to figure out about you, whether they think you're, you know, what they think your political views are, what they think you're, you know, everything is basically. So this is basically everything marketers would want to know. So this Fisher's dream.
So this is another one of those things where you didn't intentionally do business with a company called Exactis.
Mm. Yeah.
They intentionally
Which makes them all the worse.
You. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And then for our UK listeners, there was a major breach at Ticketmaster, who are a major, major, like if there's a concert happening on the British Isles, the chances are very high that Ticketmaster are going to be the ones selling the tickets. So this is a big deal. They had a breach. They have contacted everyone who was affected. So if you're caught up in this, you should have been contacted by Ticketmaster. And the Naked Security article gives you a nice rundown of the steps you need to take. So any of our British listeners who've bought concert tickets, you probably want to have a read of that story to figure out whether it affects you or not. And here, just for the record, Facebook managed to accidentally email personal data to the wrong people, which is just kind of embarrassing, really, more than anything else.
This was developer analytics report to testers. That's fun.
Yeah. There's some stuff in news that was not worthy of putting in the main news section, so I'll leave it there for you to read at your leisure. But opinion and analysis contains a few things I do want to draw people's attention to. So the first is a very insightful but deeply disconcerting article from the New York Times. The title kind of says it all. Thermostats, Locks and Lights. Digital Tools of Domestic Abuse.
Ew.
Unfortunately, scumbags can use smart home technology to treat people like poop. I mean, and I guess when you think about it,
so if Steve makes me mad, I can do some things to him?
Yeah. So basically the article sort of outlines how people would find that in the middle of the night, stuff turns on and off or whatever to torment them, or they find that they can't get in or out of their own house because their door locks keep being changed on them. Yeah. And basically it's just another way that abusive partners can be abusive is through the smart technology.
Mm.
I mean, they can be abusive with everything else, so I guess it shouldn't be a surprise that smart technology is yet another avenue for abuse. But I hadn't thought of it before. It never occurred to me.
I think there was actually a Black Mirror episode where that was happening, or there's some sci-fi show I was watching where this guy needed this woman out of the house, and so that's what he started doing, you know, turning the heat up to 175 degrees, and you know,
it sounds like something Black Mirror would do. If it isn't a Black Mirror plot, it should be.
Yeah.
Because that is right up there. We talked last time briefly about the fact that there is a rather disturbing EU copyright directive wending its way through the sausage-making process that is EU law coming into being. It's mostly fine. It just contains one or two articles that are really, really, really not fine. We talked about them a little bit last time, but I came across a really good tidbits article that's sort of looking into it in more detail, so I figured I would put the link here for anyone who wanted to read more. And then the last article is one that really caught my eye because amidst all of this talk about why, you know, we should get rid of encryption and throw in back doors and stuff, it's just a reminder that the reason we encrypt stuff is not to keep the police out. That's a side effect. The reason we encrypt stuff is to keep ourselves safe. A, from criminals, but also, and more importantly, in many, many parts of the world, the biggest threat to a lot of people is their so-called government. And that's especially true in places living under the likes of the Taliban or IS, those kind of organizations.
And by the IS wasn't obvious to me what that was, the Islamic State.
Oh, how do you guys, when you put it in headlines in America, how does it show up?
I don't know. But when I read it as a headline, I had to go read what it stood for. There was ISIS.
Yeah, they're always IS here in our newspapers.
Okay. Well, in any case, this was a fascinating article about how important that encryption is. Keep going.
Yeah, because basically it's the story of schoolgirls who ISIS tried to stop from learning because, well, you're not supposed to do that, don't you know? And the girls were like, yeah, well, we're having none of this. And they used WhatsApp, with the joys of its encryption, to get together and teach themselves. And they're now, the article ends with, and now they're anxiously awaiting their exam results.
Yeah.
So fingers crossed, touch wood, that they have all done extremely well on their exams, because they bloody well deserve to.
Yeah. So some of the details that really were amazing to me was, so they're not allowed to study. If they're caught with blank note paper, that's one of the things they can be beaten for. And they break pens and rulers if they're found with them, that sort of thing. So some of these girls would pretend to go shopping at this nearby town and would attend school, but they'd use their mobile phones and WhatsApp to smuggle out the knowledge they were getting to give to the other girls when they got back. I mean, anybody who underestimates women, don't mess yep. with us, you know? I mean, come on. I mean, what an amazing desire to learn. I mean, it's a great success story, but your point is well taken. The point of the article is, yeah, if they had allowed a backdoor on WhatsApp just for one group, these girls would be dead. I mean, it's that serious of a statement, right?
It is. And the simple fact is, there's no such thing as a magic unicorn backdoor only for the good guys. Everyone wants to think you can make this unicorn. No, unicorns aren't real. You know, if you put in a backdoor, you have put in a backdoor.
Right.
Just, you know, you can't have both ways. It's either there or it isn't. So, you know, it's important that we have this point of view on things, as well as the obvious, yes, but terrorists could abuse this technology too, which is also true. It's, you know, chainsaws can cut down trees and help you manage your farmland and grow crops that save millions, or they can murder people.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you get rid of chainsaws or blunt them. Oh, no, we can't have a sharp chainsaw. That could be used to kill people. Anyway. To be honest, that's kind of everything I want to draw people's attention to. And you managed to provide us with the palate cleanser for this week. So do you want to go ahead and cleanse our palate? Although it's pretty cleansed after that story, but
yeah, you know, yeah,
cleanse it again.
Apparently there's something called Edinburgh Fringe. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it.
The Edinburgh Fringe. Okay, so I'll give a bit of context as a European here. The Edinburgh Fringe is the most significant, important stand-up comedy festival in the whole of the English-speaking world, probably. If you are an up-and-coming stand-up comedian, the Edinburgh Fringe is where you need to be. So here in Europe, the Edinburgh Fringe is a really big deal when it comes to stand-up comedy.
Okay, all right. Well, stand-up comedian Nick Helm was judged to have the best joke of the festival, and the joke was, I needed a password 8 characters long, so I picked Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. I liked it. It made me giggle. Apparently, that's been around for a while, but it made the headlines here, so I thought that was kind of cute. But it definitely goes along with the lines of what we talk about here, right?
That wasn't the one in the message you sent me.
Oh, did I send the wrong one?
Fishing. Oh, you sent another one that also made me
shoot,
laugh.
I thought it was about fishing, but I found the wrong one. Okay, hang on. Let's keep going. Wait a minute. Maybe the link is wrong. Okay, oh, hang on.
The one you gave me is... Oh, no, sorry.
That's right.
The one unattributed from the comments on the same page.
That's where it was.
Fish and you...
Yeah, here it is. Give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and he'll use your credit card to pay for dinner. That was the right one.
In both cases, though, what it shows, the fact that jokes about passwords can win prizes at Edinburgh Fringe means that finally, at long last, we are succeeding in getting the message out there that at least people know what they should be doing. They're not doing it yet, but at least they know that they should be, and that's surely got to be the first step.
Right, right. Well, I've put the actual quote in the show notes, too, so that we, so in case anybody comes across the show notes, they can make sure they get the right joke there. I was reading the other one going, well, I didn't think that one was that funny, Bart. Why did you pick that one?
I laughed.
No, but the second one was the funnier one.
I laughed at both, actually. I quite liked the, you know, 8 characters long, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
There you go. All right, Bart. Well, this has been great. We I don't feel like I want to go shoot myself at the end of this, so that's a good day.
Yeah, I think it must be midsummer. It's a bit quiet. We're into the silly season.
That sounds good to me.
I was going
to
say, regardless of the fact that it's the silly season, you should nonetheless, at all times, stay patched, stay secure.
Well, I didn't really intend this entire episode to be a Bart Bouchat's love fest, but it kind of turned into that. But hey, there's not enough love going around in the world, so I think it's okay. But that is going to wind us up for this week. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions. I've not gotten a lot of dumb questions lately. You can send those comments and suggestions to me by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, @podfeet. Heck, Instagram me, @podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com. Want to become a Patreon? Go to podfeet.com/Patreon. After you go to let's-talk.ie and become a patron of Bart's. You want to join our Facebook group? It's at podfeet.com/Facebook. Want to join Google Plus? Podfeet.com/Google Plus. You want to join our Discord chat? Where do you think that is? Podfeet.com/chat. Want to help out by just using some Amazon affiliate links? Go to podfeet.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, like Jerry Jr. did for the first time in a long time, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.